Your conference is being recorded.
Well, good afternoon. This is Rosemary Heiser with BOK Financial Advisor Trust Services, and welcome to our Trust Education Program. We've created this program to support our advisor community in the area of trust as we develop relationships with our advisor-friendly trust services. Next month, join us on March 22nd for a session focused on estate planning litigation pointers, a litigator's perspective. And our speaker is Kevin Spencer, supporter of BOK Financial in the Bank of Texas location. As you're aware, each program has a professional presenter discussing an aspect of trust and estate planning specifically geared towards the advisor community. And of course, if you have any suggestions on future speakers or specific content that you'd like presented, or any other general comments to improve our program, we'd love to hear them. We're pleased to have several of our markets participating in today's presentation. As a housekeeping issue, this call will be recorded for future use, so if you are listening in, please put your phone on mute so that we can minimize the background noise. If you do have any additional questions or something comes up that's a little more state-specific in nature, please discuss that with your host or the trust manager there, and they can address it specifically. And depending on time, and our speaker today with Bob, he will address questions at the end of the session or depending on the subject. This, as well as all future programs, is approved for 1.5 hours of CFP continuing education credits in the area of estate planning. So please make sure you sign this, complete the sign-in sheet and include your CFP number. We'll go ahead and submit your participation, and it should show up in your continuing education log. However, we do realize sometimes there are technical glitches or updates in the system. So if something doesn't show up, please just contact us, and we'll make sure that you get credit for your attendance. Today, our presenter is a great friend of our company, an avid speaker at various programs, Bob Kirkland. And our topic is estate planning strategies for retirement assets. Let me just tell you a little bit more about Bob Kirkland. He's a managing partner of the law firm at Kirkland Woods Martinson LLP and has offices in Liberty, Missouri, Springfield, Missouri, and Overland Park, Kansas. He works with a variety of individual clients and advisors handling the preparation of wills, living trusts, durable power of attorneys, irrevocable trusts, charitable trusts, and minors trusts, as well as counseling clients in areas of gifting techniques, asset protection, charitable planning, and business succession planning. He also advises fiduciaries in estate, conservatorship, and trust administration matters. Mr. Kirkland is a fellow of the American College of Trust and Estate Council, known as ACTEC, a past Missouri state chair of ACTEC, and a past member of ACTEC Board of Regents and Executive Committee. He's also a member of the Employee Benefits Committee, Communications Committee, Sponsorship Advisory Chair Committee, and Long Range Planning Committee, and Bylaws and Manuals Committee of ACTEC. He's listed in the most recent edition of the Best Lawyers in America and Super Lawyers. Bob Kirkland has successfully completed the Effective Probate Mediation Training Course sponsored by ACTEC and frequently serves as a mediator of trust and estate disputes. Among several professional and civic activities, Bob is also a chancellor of the Heart of America ACTEC Fellow Institute and is vice chair of the Missouri Bar Probate and Trust Committee. You are very active, Bob. Bob Kirkland is a frequent author and lecturer in the estate planning and charitable giving areas, and we're very pleased to have him involved in our education session today, as well as other ones in the past that he's been very supportive of, as well as members in his firm. So I will this time go ahead and turn it over to Bob, and he will open it up when appropriate for any questions along the way. Thank you, Bob. I'll let it go from here.
Thank you, Rosemary. Yes, I'll take a breath every once in a while ask for questions, certainly over the phone. Those who are here, just feel free to raise your hand if something pops in your mind, and I'll make sure Daryl answers it. So today we're talking about what do we do with our clients' retirement plans, their 401ks, their IRAs, their Roths. And if we all take a step back and honestly assess how much of our planning time is proportionately involved with retirement plan assets, do you feel it's really appropriate? And certainly before 2010, a lot of our focus was on the estate and gift tax. We had $600,000 exemption. We had 55% maximum rates. We had actually brackets in the estate tax. And all of that's changed. As you know, with the Tax Act that occurred at the end of last year, we now have a We don't have it official yet, but we're told that the exemption is $11,180,000 per person. So for a couple with portability, that's $22,360,000. So that's a lot of wealth before any estate tax gets paid. And the same exemption for generation skipping tax. So people often ask me now, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? Well, fortunately, we have other things. We have greedy children, we have blended families, we have retirement assets. And I think our focus shifts now to income tax planning, and part of that income tax planning is dealing with retirement assets. Indeed, before the act that occurred in December, the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center told us that the estate and gift tax exemptions at the level of 2017 impacted only 0.15% of the population, of the U.S. population. That's not 15%, that's not 1.5, but 0.15. Now, we find ourselves still filing a good number of federal estate tax returns for portability reasons. And for those of you who think estate tax returns are not getting audited, they are. It's just a whole different ballgame nowadays. There's so few that are getting filed that if there's any real estate or business interest, they're probably going to be audited. I just found out this week that one we filed a year ago is under further review. Hopefully that's not the referees sitting in a box in New York that are looking at it, but we'll find out. So the estate tax is not terribly impactful across the spectrum of our clients anymore. But clearly, almost every client we deal with has a retirement plan interest of some size to it that requires our attention. So it's a different focus, certainly, than when I first started practicing just 10 years ago or so. But let's remind ourselves why retirement benefits are so unique and really do merit more of our attention. First of all, we know that during our client's life, their retirement assets remain pregnant with future income tax liability. In the vast majority of situations, every dollar that comes out, either to the participant or his or her beneficiaries, is going to be taxed. We also know that maximum funding of retirement plans are a very effective asset protection technique. When I first started practicing, again, just a few years ago, no one talked about asset protection except for doctors and real estate developers. And dentists didn't know they were in trouble. Nowadays, that's on top of mind for almost every client. We're in a much more litigious society. We're in a 50%+ divorce rate culture. So asset protection is important, and retirement plans are a very easy and effective answer. I like to call it using the everyday tool of our trade to accomplish asset protection as well as other things. We also know about retirement plans that the mere completion of a beneficiary designation form, which often happens by an account clerk at a bank, or at, not to pick on them, or Edward Jones or A.G. Edwards, not picking on them, I'm picking on the 25-year-old clerk who can barely find their way into the building. They're helping them fill out that form, and unbeknownst to any of them, that form is triggering a myriad of timing issues, taxation issues, all sorts of dire circumstances. This hit home with me a couple of years ago. I had done an estate plan for a town veterinarian who took care of numerous dogs and cats for me as a young kid, and he came to see me, I think it was in 2001, for his estate plan. It was my pleasure to take care of Doc. And he had a little bit of a complicated situation. He had three adult children from a previous marriage and a longtime companion. And in his words, he was only going to get married once. My wife says the same thing. But anyway, so we designed a revocable trust for him that benefited both his significant other and his three children and kind of balanced all that. And then we created an attachment. You're going to hear me say that a dozen times this afternoon. An attachment for him to use for his IRA, which was his most significant asset. And rather than send that to the trust, we created an attachment that really mirrored the percentage distribution that his trust contained. So that then each person, each beneficiary, could set up a separate account on his death, stretch the distributions, all that good stuff. So he was in good shape at that point, not to pat myself on the back. But and then I never saw Doc again professionally while he was alive, nor have I seen him since, for that matter. But he passed away in 2012 or 13. And I learned shortly after his death that he had switched investment advisors since the 2001 plan. And his new advisor said, you know, you really don't need this fancy attachment. We'll just name your estate as the beneficiary of your IRA. I think everyone in this room, judging by the looks on your face, know that's the last thing they want to do. And so we worked our way through it. We laid a heavy guilt trip on the investment provider, and they agreed to do separate accounts, even though that's probably not permitted under regulations. We still had to do distributions over the life expectancy of the significant other, who was 30 years older than any of the kids. And so it greatly impacted the kids on how rapidly they had to take their share out. I don't know if anybody got sued, but they certainly had something to talk about with that investment advisor. Unlike any other asset, if we name a trust as beneficiary, it creates a myriad of requirements and issues we need to be cognizant of if the beneficiaries want to stretch distributions over their life expectancy. As I already stated, unlike other forms of inheritance, almost every dollar coming out is subject to income tax. In some states, unfortunately not the one we're sitting in, but in the one next door, a beneficiary's inherited IRA is also exempt from creditors, and we'll talk about that here around 4 o'clock or so. Finally, retirement assets create unique opportunities for our clients who want to do charitable giving both during life and at death, and we'll definitely talk about that here this afternoon. So all of those reasons make retirement plans unique and something we need to address at the planning stage. So I'm not going to read you every word of my outline, which you'll be thankful of. Rosemary made a comment about the length of my outline. It wasn't a positive comment. But in my defense, I do this talk several times a year across the country, and I just kind of keep a master outline that I keep updated. I don't like reinventing the wheel. I'm lazy. So that combination leads me to do this. And then I kind of pick and choose what I talk about. So if I don't talk about something you have a question about, you let me know. I'd be happy to, again, have Daryl answer your question. Let's just review what the rules are as a pretext to getting into trusts and charities and all that. If we name individuals as beneficiaries of a retirement plan. So we know that during the taxpayer's life, they have to start taking required distributions at age 70 and a half. Specifically, their required beginning date, or RBD, is April 1 of the year following the year when they turned, not 70, 70 and a half. Who writes these rules? Jeez. Now, as you also know, for example, I turned 70 and a half, I won't tell you the year, but it's going to be a July 27th someday, actually June 27th someday. And so my required beginning date will be April 1 of the following year. But I'll probably take the first distribution in that year before so I don't have to double up in that next year. So really think of it as the year they turn 70 and a half. In my case, the rule is a good thing because my birthday is December, so I get one more year anyway. So the IRS has a table that takes into the account my life expectancy and the life expectancy of a hypothetical spouse who is 10 years younger. Now, my wife happened to attend one of my presentations a few years ago, and first thing she asked me about was that hypothetical spouse who's 10 years younger and what her name was. But in any event, that's what the table provides. If the taxpayer is married to a spouse who is more than 10 years younger, they can use a joint life table that's even more favorable. So otherwise, we all use the same table. And so that regime starts when you're 70 and a half. Let's talk for a moment, because I get this question all the time from my wealthier clients that say, gee whiz, I've got to start taking this RMD, and it's really a pain. I don't need it. I don't want it. Why do I have to take it? And, of course, I start out by explaining, look, you've had incredible tax deferral for 50 years, at least 40, depending on when you started retirement saving, and now it's time to pay the piper. Well, no one likes me. They're not going to pay me for that statement. That's for darn sure. So I have to follow that up with, well, here are a few little techniques you can think about for reducing the impact of your required minimum distribution, or RMD. First of all, your client can buy a qualified longevity annuity contract. This contract does not start paying an annuity until the client turns 85, so it buys 15 more years. That's in stark contrast to the normal rule, is that you've got to take that minimum amount out every year after you're 70 and a half. But here's an example where you can delay that. And the IRS has made an exception for qualified longevity annuities for up to $125,000 of the IRA balance, or 25% of the IRA if that amount is less than $125,000. So if the IRA is $500,000 or more, they can take out they can direct $125,000 to buy this annuity contract, and that postpones the RMD on that piece until they're 85. Not a huge deal, but it's something. Gives me something to say other than tough luck or tough nuggies, bucko, or whatever. If the client is still working after age 70 and a half, they can participate in that employer's retirement plan and thereby reduce their compensation by tax-deductible contributions. And those contributions produce a deduction that reduces the income tax effect of the RMD, kind of indirectly. So you have the RMD, but you're reducing your overall income by further contributions to a plan and reducing the tax impact of the RMD. If the client's self-employed in a legitimate business, they can do their own SEP IRA and redirect some of their compensation to that SEP and use the RMD in place of that compensation. Again, not a fail-safe, perfect blanket, but it all little things together will help a little bit. If your client works for a nonprofit entity or a for-profit company where they own less than 5%, and that company has a qualified retirement plan that accepts rollovers from an IRA, the client can roll over or do a plan-to-plan transfer of his or her IRA into the company plan and then defer taking RMDs until they actually retire. So that's something that is maybe a little broader method of avoiding the impact of the RMD. Finally, there's the good old plain old Roth IRA conversion. As we know, the client has to pay some income tax upon shifting money from the regular IRA to a Roth, but from that point forward, it's free of tax. Obviously, the client must be willing to pay the tax, and we often recommend that in a year where they've made a larger than normal charitable gift, maybe had medical expenses, and of course with the new limits on deductions, our playing field is a little more limited for this now. But still, I think the Roth is a good play for a lot of clients. We'll talk later about how the new law impacts Roth IRAs and the ability to recharacterize those Roth IRA conversions. So that's kind of a survey of a few little things that in the aggregate could really help your clients in reducing the impact of RMDs. It's hard to feel sorry for people who don't need an RMD, but I muster up sympathy for a few minutes while I'm meeting with them. So let's look at now after death, which is where we come in when we're helping them do estate planning. I think we're all familiar with the rules that if it fits their dispositive scheme and their family situation, the spouse is always the best choice for primary beneficiary. And that's because the spouse has the most options. In most cases, absent special facts, upon my death, my spouse should roll over my retirement plan interest to a spousal rollover IRA, particularly if she's a lot younger. which she's not today, but in any event, because that spouse can essentially start the clock ticking. Let's say I cool the room temperature today, or I slide off the road going back north today. So my spouse is 59, don't tell her I told you, but she could roll over my IRA and not touch it for 11 and a half years. And the tax, the tax deferral she'll enjoy produces tremendous growth during that 11 years. So that's clearly the play. No other individual has that option. Okay. Now, we've had several situations where, again, designations went awry and somehow the estate gets named or the revocable trust gets named as the primary beneficiary. But we still save the day by getting the IRS to issue a ruling that says, look, yes, the estate is named, but the spouse is the primary beneficiary of the estate, and the spouse is the executor. So the spouse is really controlling the game. So therefore, we ought to still be eligible for a spousal rollover. And there are literally hundreds of private letter rulings that have said, yes, you're right, the spouse can roll that over. And so it's led some of us to say, gee whiz, you know, the spouse has to pay $10,000 for a actually $28,000 now for a private letter ruling, and then wait for a year, year and a half to get a response sitting on pins and needles. Isn't there a better way? You're consistently holding that rollover applies in this broad set of facts. Will you please issue a revenue ruling that we all can rely on? Because the rule is every taxpayer is not allowed to rely on someone else's private letter ruling they paid good money with. And most providers will say, we're not going to treat this as a rollover unless you get a private letter ruling. So at ACTEC, our committee has asked for a published ruling. First, we did it in 2009, no response. We've repeated the request for the last, whatever it is, 8-9 years, and zero response. But we're going to be diligent. We're going to be like Bob was in high school looking for a prom date. We're going to keep asking till somebody says yes. Okay? I got you. So that's an issue out there. So don't give up in this area. If you get some bad facts, take another look at it. I'm happy to help if you want to consult with someone. There may be a way out of a bad designation. There are some examples of a couple rulings in my materials where the IRS has given a favorable ruling. Another recent development in the whole spousal rollover area has to do with same-sex marriages. And I think we all know now that the Windsor case from the Supreme Court in 2013 held that for federal law purposes, both ERISA and Department of Labor purposes, a same-sex marriage receives the same treatment as an opposite-sex marriage. And the IRS has since issued rulings to that effect as well. So for all things federal law, remember that if, in fact, I had meetings with same-sex couples in the last couple years where they were debating whether or not to get married. And one of them had a civil union that was issued by the local court in Chicago, in Illinois. And a civil union expressly does not qualify for spousal rollover treatment. And I said, look, I often, my legal advice normally doesn't include getting married, but in your case, you know, you're cohabitating, you're acting like a married couple, you ought to change that civil union to a marriage so you can qualify. They both worked and had significant retirement plan assets. You know, it's a no-brainer. You ought to get married so you can take advantage of the spousal rollover treatment. And it's interesting because I've known two sets of same-sex couples who have not gotten married for family reasons or whatever. And, you know, I think it's our job to point out, hey, the tax consequences weigh in favor of getting married. So it's kind of a whole new world, but we need to be open to talking about that with those couples. Likewise, on the heels of Windsor, we had the case called Obergefell, and that held that for state law purposes, same-sex marriages are to be treated as opposite-sex marriages for all state employee benefits, and under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, it's not fair, it's not constitutional to discriminate against same-sex marriages. So now for state law purposes, we have the same result. So just keep that in mind as you're doing planning, how that might impact beneficiary designations and the availability of a spousal rollover. Now, what if we have an individual who's not a spouse as beneficiary? So there, our whole key is, do we have a designated with a capital D beneficiary, capital B? Obviously, there is a beneficiary listed on the designation form, but there's a special category for stretching purposes of a designated beneficiary. Certain beneficiaries don't qualify. Charities, states, estates, companies all do not constitute designated beneficiaries, meaning our options are limited for how long we can stretch distributions post-death from the IRA. Individuals always qualify as a designated beneficiary. Only certain trusts qualify, and we will go through that perhaps ad nauseum here in a few minutes. But let's talk about these rules in the context of an individual. So if there is a designated beneficiary, if I name my three children as the beneficiary of my IRA, if I die before I've reached 70 and a half, then let's say I named one child to make it easy. That child then can stretch the distribution over his or her remaining life expectancy. If I don't have an individual and I die before my required beginning date or 70 and a half, they only have an option of taking it out over 5 short years. If I have a designated beneficiary and it's after 70 and a half when I cool to room temperature, the beneficiary can either use his or her life expectancy or my remaining life expectancy had I lived a full life expectancy, whichever is longer. Usually it's the beneficiary's life expectancy, unless I name my mother or something like that. If I don't have a beneficiary, a designated beneficiary, and I die after my required beginning date, they're stuck with my remaining life expectancy. Okay, Derek.
Question for you.
Yes.
If we have mom who is in a nursing home and has Alzheimer's and is incurring substantial costs, and son who is her only heir decides to do a Roth conversion with her IRA, her power of attorney doesn't allow him to name beneficiaries. And so upon mom's death, he sets up a Roth account, a brand new Roth account while she is having, while she has Alzheimer's. The custodian agreement does name beneficiaries. But they would not respect him filling out a beneficiary designation form. Would she be deemed to have a designated beneficiary, you think?
Depends on who's named. So let's assume first he has the power under the durable power of attorney to do the Roth.
Okay.
If you've gotten that far, he doesn't have the power to go ahead and name a beneficiary.
Right.
So if the custodial agreement says, your children equally shall be deemed to be the beneficiaries, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So his only issue is, so it wouldn't go through probate. He would be the designated beneficiary. And even though it's a Roth and there's no tax liability, there's still an incentive to take out the minimum amount because you're getting tax-free deferral while the stuff stays in there.
Right,
I think you'd be okay.
Okay.
Interesting set of facts, yeah. Okay. Any questions on the phone so far? Anyone still awake? All right, I'll keep going. So we talked about the spousal rollover, and just to be clear, if I name my son, he cannot do the same kind of rollover my spouse can. So if I name any other individual, they have to start taking minimum distributions by the end of the following year. Okay? They can use their life expectancy, but they can't, they can't wait till they're 70 and a half like the spouse can. That's why the spouse is the king or queen in this area. Now, what if I name my three children, Spencer, Chad, and Amanda? Okay? If they do nothing after I die by September 30th of the following year, they can only stretch distributions over the oldest child's life expectancy. What should they do instead? Before September 30th, now there are various deadlines. You don't have to start the distributions till December 31. You don't have to provide copies of documentation till October 31, but you have to do separate accounts by September 30th. So those are too many dates for my small brain, so I want to have everything in place by September 30th, and I know I'm good. So by September 30th, what they should do is go to the provider of the IRA and say, listen, we want to do separate accounts. We want to have a Spencer Inherited IRA. Actually, it's Bob IRA, FBO Spencer, Bob IRA, FBO Chad, and Bob IRA, FBO Amanda. Then, if they get that done by September 30th, those separate accounts are each treated separately for minimum distribution purposes, and they each can use their own life expectancy. We'll talk about where trusts tie you up if you try to do that with a trust involved. So the problem at the planning stage is we can't mandate that. There's one way we can, which we'll talk about, but if we just name the kids, they've got to do the right thing. I try to clue them in with my attachment by including some language like, you know, each beneficiary has the right to set up their own account, aka you better do this. but you know, I'm gone. I can't make them do that post my death. If I find out I can, I'll let you know. But I don't think I'll be able to. Let me do a quick diversion and talk about an interesting new development. I'm trying to hit on the most recent development that's occurred in the last couple of 3 years. This involves a situation where someone leaves employment, retires, goes to another employer, and doesn't take immediate action with respect to their 401k or 403b at the old employer, and the employer HR department gets nervous and sends them a check, sends them the balance of their 401k or their 403b. Here it is. You've left, so we're required to give you a lump sum distribution. Well, that act starts a very quick clock ticking. For that not to be taxable, the employee or the participant must roll that over into an IRA or another retirement plan. That 60 days goes really fast, and a lot of people miss it. Hence, there have been hundreds of private letter rulings requesting a continuance or a waiver of that 60-day period. And the IRS has been very liberal in granting that. Again, there was a hue and cry about let's you know, we're spending a lot of money. It only costs $10,000 to ask for this kind of ruling, but that's $10,000 I just soon have. So can you give us some guidance? Well, the IRS did. And that was Rev Proc 2016-47. I'm on page 20. Actually, I think you have different page numbers because she made it smaller type. She didn't like the length of my outline. I don't think she liked my outline. Here, that's okay. I like it. Rev Proc 2016-47 was issued in August of 2016, and it establishes a self-certification procedure for taxpayers. Self-certification always sounds nice, but what does that mean? It's a double-edged sword, so us folks who prepare returns are really taking some risk. In other words, we're implicitly certifying what the taxpayers told us is their version of the facts, so beware of that. But in any event, it says if you meet three requirements, you don't have to get a private letter ruling. You get to waive the 60-day period and do a qualified rollover of that distribution. So the three requirements are you must not have previously been denied a waiver by the IRS. You must not have been able to complete the rollover due to one of 11 blessed excuses. And three, you must complete the rollover as soon as practical after you've discovered the error and you're no longer prevented from completing the rollover. So what are the 11 blessed reasons? Well, I'm not going to read all of them to you, but they're the usual suspects. And the first thing the taxpayer does is blame the financial institution. So the first blessed area is an error was committed by the financial institution receiving the contribution or making the distribution to which the contribution relates. So throw the bank under the bus is the first excuse. Secondly, the distribution was made in the form of a check, which was misplaced and never cashed. Thirdly, the distribution was deposited into an account that the taxpayer mistakenly thought was an IRA. The taxpayer's residence was damaged. A member of the taxpayer's family died. I've got a secretary whose grandmother died at least four times. But anyway, the taxpayer or a member of the family was seriously ill. The taxpayer was incarcerated. Postal error. Post office is another easy suspect. So those are some of the 11, but there's one that's missing that's really conspicuous. Anybody have a guess? The death of the taxpayer. I mean, if I get one of those checks and I die 15 days later, don't you think my estate's going to want to roll it over? So that's not one of the reasons. So I guess you have to say that the taxpayer was seriously ill. He had breathing issues. The heart wasn't pumping quite as fast. Anyway, it's just silliness, but I think that's clearly an excuse, although it's not one of the blessed ones. As I said, be careful if you're a preparer, because you're relying on your taxpayer saying, these are the facts, and you're signing that return with them as a preparer, and if those facts turn out to be something else, you might be subject to some preparer penalties. So self-certification isn't always what it seems to be. But it's a nice development in one of those blessed circumstances. So I've talked about separate accounts. Let me go over a situation that's another illustration of that. Let's say I name my favorite charity to receive 25% of my IRA and each of my three children to receive 25% each. And they don't do anything by September 30th. I misspoke earlier. They can still do separate accounts by the end of that next year. So they have until December 31. What happens on September 30th is the beneficiary determination date. That's the critical date where we decide, do we have designated beneficiaries or not? If they've done nothing, what do we have? We have a charity and three individuals. If they've done nothing, that account is not eligible for the stretch because we have one non-designated beneficiary, that being the charity. What should happen post my death? They should do separate accounts with the provider, and they ought to pay that charity out in full before September 30th. So on that beneficiary determination date, who's left? The three kids, and they can proceed to do separate accounts and stretching. So that's where the September 30th date is key. So if we wait to do separate accounts till after that, we're too late if we've left the charity in there. You don't think the charity's going to complain about getting their money soon, are they? No. So that's a key part of post-death planning. Again, the challenge is, will we even be hired by the kids? You know, Dad was our client, so that can create a problem sometimes. What if I, instead of naming my three kids, I've named my trust? We haven't talked about the trust rules yet, but let's assume that my trust says on my death, the trust will be paid out three ways to my three kids. But my IRA beneficiary is my trust. I die, and we think the trust will qualify to be a designated beneficiary. I'm going to go over those rules just in a minute. So that's not the issue. The issue is, can we do separate accounts so each of the kids can stretch on their own life expectancy? The answer under the regulations is no. But there's a private letter ruling in 2015. It's 2015-03024. And it provides a lesson to the effect that you can't believe every single word literally in the regulations. Here, the letter ruling said, yes, you can. The trust, in my example, can set up three accounts. Bob IRA, FBO Spencer Trust, Bob IRA, FBO Chad Trust, and on. And they said that trust qualifies as a designated beneficiary. The setting up of those three accounts will not be a taxable transfer. They can be three separate accounts. The rub is the ruling confirmed that they still can only use the life expectancy of the oldest of the three. So why is that a good result? We still didn't get three life expectancies. Well, it's a good result in my family because they still have separate accounts, which means if sister decides to take out more than the minimum amount in a given year, it doesn't affect brothers or if one of the brothers does that. Likewise, they may have very different investment allocation desires. They can now do that. Whereas before this ruling, they had to be hand in hand on all that stuff. They can each use separate investment advisors. So this ruling is key not for the distribution amount purposes, but for at least allowing separate accounts for all the practical reasons that we want them. I mean, my kids are in Chicago, Birmingham, and Charlotte, so they're not going to have the same investment advisor, much less the same investment desires. I can guarantee you that. One is very conservative and one is not, and the other one plays referee half the time. Steve can probably guess who those are. He knew my kids. So that's a significant ruling, not really for tax purposes, but for other practical purposes in family planning. So let's talk about trusts, because I can't tell you how many times I inherit a client, or I, worse yet, inherit a trust administration where the client's already died, and the revocable trust is named as the beneficiary. Clearly, you don't want to do that with surviving spouse unless special circumstances. In other words, I would avoid, like the plague, naming a trust. Have I done it with clients? Absolutely, because there are reasons that compel it. A second marriage, where they very much don't want to leave it all under the surviving spouse's discretion or determination because they want to make sure their kids of the first marriage still get something. So then we're talking about a marital trust, which we'll talk about more in a moment. What if you have a special needs child? Clearly, if you direct an IRA to that special needs child or to the guardian of the special needs child, you've ruined their eligibility for Medicaid and other special needs programs. Not all, but most. The beneficiary is a minor. Trust is the answer. The beneficiary is a spendthrift or has substance abuse issues. So there are lots of reasons where, you know, the client is thinking trust. In those situations, the reasons may be compelling enough to name a trust. It's our job then to tell them what the consequences of that are. They're picking which demon is the least harmful at that point. The tax man or the eligibility for, or, you know, or the ruining of this beneficiary. Yes, sir.
You may be about to get to this, but oftentimes the question that pops up for us is spouse's primary beneficiary is the no-brainer.
Yeah.
But as contingent beneficiary, should we choose the trust or should we
you betcha.
Try to just mirror the trust with the kids?
You betcha. You betcha. That's exactly what I'm getting to.
Okay.
So if you don't mind,
I can wait.
If I don't answer the question, you come far back at me. So in those situations, one of those scenarios I've just mentioned where it's compelling to name the trust as either the primary if there's no spouse or as contingent if there is a spouse, what do we next got to be sure of? Well, we want that trust to meet the qualifications of a designated beneficiary. In order to do that, that trust must qualify as what some folks call a see-through trust and what others call a look-through trust. There are five qualifications for a trust to be designated or treated as a see-through trust and therefore a designated beneficiary. If we meet those requirements, essentially the trust is ignored and we look through the trust to the oldest beneficiary, and that's whose life expectancy we use as a measuring stick. The first four tests are the trust must be valid under state law. Well, if I don't meet that test, I've got a lot of problems as the preparer. Secondly, the trust must be irrevocable or become irrevocable at the taxpayer's death. Now, when these regulations were first proposed in 1989, and I remember the date well because I was scheduled to do a talk down at MU Law School at the old Cratcher Symposium, which doesn't exist anymore, and 3 days beforehand, these regs came out. Those were not fun three nights for me trying to study up on these regulations. But in any event, when the regulations were first proposed, it said the trust must be irrevocable, period. So if we were naming a trust, we were having to prepare separate irrevocable trusts in order to meet that qualification. Thankfully, they got a lot of comments and they changed that when they finalized their regs. So it's okay to be a revocable trust that becomes irrevocable on the participant's death. Thirdly, the trust beneficiaries must be identifiable. Well, again, if I haven't met that requirement, I've got a lot of people to answer to. And then fourth, certain documentation must be provided to the plan administrator, not by September 30th, not by December 31, but by October 31. They drive me crazy. And what's that? Well, it's basically either a summary of all the key provisions of the trust, or what I do, because again, I'm lazy, give them the copy of the whole trust. That satisfies the requirement. So if those four tests are met, then the trust will qualify as a designated beneficiary if the beneficiaries of the trust are only individuals. So if my trust says half to my favorite charity and half to my kids, that trust will not qualify. Okay? Now, in looking at who the beneficiaries of the trust are, who do I have to count and who do I get to ignore? Not answered by the regulations. The regulations tell us that you have to include today's primary beneficiary. You have to include the contingent beneficiaries. And you can ignore the mere potential successors. But they don't bother to define the difference between contingent and mere potential successors. Well, that creates a problem for us at the planning stage because we don't have any definite answers. So if my trust says it's in trust for my son's life, and then upon his death, it gets paid to his children. So if he doesn't have any, it goes to William Jewell College. We have a charity. Uh-oh. So the question is, we know my son is the primary. He's considered. If he has children, those would be the contingent beneficiaries. And can I argue with success that William Jewell is a mere potential successor? Don't know. Now, we've had that rule now for 20 years. And we still, again, ACTEC has asked for a published ruling to tell us what the rules are. Because, frankly, private rulings have been all over the map. In one case, they held that if it's paid out at age 30, then we stop at the child. Because we'll bet the child's going to make it to age 30. Okay? If it's a later age, then you got to consider the grandchildren. And they didn't answer the question whether you have to include the next layer of potential beneficiaries. In one ruling where it was income to son, and then son had a power of appointment as to who got it, they said the trust doesn't qualify because he might appoint a charity. So the private letter rulings are literally all over the map. Last year, we got an excellent ruling, and a friend of mine in Pasadena named Steve Tritton, to his credit, had the guts to ask for this ruling and the ability to advocate for the right result. And this is important. It is to me anyway. I think it's, I'm hoping it's reflective of the IRS's current thinking, which actually makes sense. And it's private letter ruling 2016-33025, published in fall of 2016. In this case, the trust was named as the primary beneficiary. There was no spouse. Under the terms of the trustee was to distribute all of the income to the child, and the trustee had discretion to invade the principal for the usual health, education, maintenance, and support. And when the child reached age 50, then the trust terminated and everything was distributed to the child. If the child died prior to age 50, the trust was to be distributed to any children of the child. If the child and all the child's children were deceased, then to siblings of the decedent. If all those people were gone, then it went to several charitable organizations. Yikes. Again, on the face of the regulations, there is no clear answer. So they asked for a private ruling, and the IRS said the only beneficiaries that must be taken into account are the child and the child's children. And the siblings and the charity were mere potential successors, and they ruled that this trust qualified to be a designated beneficiary and could stretch distributions over the child's life. Now, what if the child didn't have children? I think the ruling, I'm speculating, would have said the child's the primary, the siblings are the contingent, and the charity is still a mere potential successor. But, of course, that would have meant they'd use the oldest sibling's life expectancy. In this case, the child had a couple children, and so the child was the oldest, and that was the result. I think that's the right result. But, again, it's only a private ruling, and the rule is other taxpayers cannot rely on it. I will tell you, I have used this ruling a little bit as a hammer to try to persuade and have persuaded a couple of providers to give us this treatment without having my client spend good money on a private letter rule. So it is useful. Even though we're not entitled to rely on it with the service, we can use it in negotiating with providers on how to pay out retirement plans on the death of a client. Questions, comments about that? Any on the phone? Any here? Okay. Keep plowing away here. So we know that the whole designating a trust thing produces iffy results, and none of us like iffy. I like it least of all. I want to be able to tell the client, here's what's going to happen pursuant to the plan we're putting in place. That's simply not available when we're naming trust. Do I do it? Yes. Do I explain the consequences potentially? Absolutely. There is a safe harbor given to us by the law. If we name a trust that constitutes a conduit trust, then that trust is automatically treated as a designated beneficiary, and the beneficiary of that trust, who is one person, which we'll show you in a moment, that's whose life expectancy we use. Now, conduit trusts are like skinny jeans. They're not for everybody. And I'm a good example of that. Anyway, a conduit trust must say that the trustee will take out the minimum distribution from the IRA based on the beneficiary's life expectancy and immediately turn around and pay that out to the beneficiary. So, okay, and that beneficiary is treated as the life we use for distribution purposes. So what's wrong with that picture? Well, that goes against the grain of the very reason we name trusts 95% of the time. So conduit trusts are not very useful in my practice. I do use them in those situations where the client doesn't have a problem, either special needs or substance abuse or spendthrift reasons, doesn't have a problem with the child being named, but they want to make sure the child is going to do the stretch. And so the answer is a conduit trust, that basically locks the child in to the whole stretching concept. The money will all come out to the trust and immediately go to the child, which you wouldn't want with special needs or a spendthrift or any of those, a minor child. But in these limited situations where the parent has no problem with the child getting the money, they just want to make sure they do the stretch. What's the difference? If they name their children, if I name Spencer, Chad, and Amanda, Chad can go in and take it all out after I die. The conduit trust locks them in to the minimum amount coming out every year over their life expectancy. And so I named three conduit trusts in that example, not just my revocable trust. And is that what you're getting to, John?
Well, you mentioned life expectancy.
Yeah.
So go ahead. No, well, you can't structure this so it's over the individual beneficiary's life.
Exactly. So what I do is I use an attachment, here I said it again, that says, on my death, the IRA shall be paid out to Spencer, Chad, and Amanda, except I want their interest paid to the Spencer share of my trust, to the Chad share of my trust, and the Amanda share of my trust, and that trust is a conduit trust. In other situations where I don't do conduit, let's say I'm only concerned about the age of my children. I'm okay with getting it, but I want some ability to not pay it all out each year. In that situation, I'm doing an accumulation trust, but I still want to qualify as a designated beneficiary. So what I do is I, first of all, I don't have a charity as a contingent beneficiary. If I do, I've got to create a separate share for that so the IRA never gets paid to charity. But what I say on the attachment is, pay that IRA out to my three kids. Any one of them who is under age 50, that share shall be directed to their share of my revocable trust. Under that scenario, I think I can use each child's life expectancy because I have three beneficiaries, three trust shares as the beneficiary. I'm willing to sleep at night on that even though there's no certainty to that result. But I include several savings clauses in my trust that basically say, if any contingent beneficiary would not qualify as a designated beneficiary, they do not get the share of my retirement plan. Trustee, try to make up their share with non-retirement assets, but to the extent you can't, their share gets reduced. So I'm precluding a charity from ever being a beneficiary of my IRA. I also put savings language in that no one who's a generation above the primary beneficiary of that trust shall be a contingent beneficiary. Because I want to be sure it's my child's lifetimes that are used as the measuring stick for distributions. If anybody would like me to go into more detail on that, I'm happy to do that by email. But those are kind of a series of savings clauses I include in my trust where I know I'm trying to get see-through or designate a beneficiary treatment. Make sense? No, it doesn't. Now, what's the other thing I've got to warn my clients about when we name a trust that's not a conduit? So I direct my children's third interest in my IRA to their share of my revocable trust on my death, and it's not a conduit, meaning the trustee is going to receive, let's say it's $20,000 for Spencer's share, and he's not going to turn around and pay $20,000 out. He's going to either accumulate it, pay some income, or pay principal. One thing the clients don't get intuitively, because most of us don't either, is that when that trust receives $20,000 from the IRA, that's taxable income, but it's not trust law income. That receipt under state law is considered in part income, and in part, trust principal. In many states, there's a uniform law that's been passed that when my trust receives an IRA distribution, 90% of it is principal, 10% is income. So what's the beneficiary get? That 10%. And that's what I want. If I didn't want that, I'd do a conduit trust. I want the trustee to accumulate that for health, education, maintenance needs, or needs down the road. What's the price I'm paying when I do that? only 10% of that $20,000 gets paid out to Spencer, and he pays the income tax on that. Who pays the income tax on the remaining $18,000? The trust. And at what level does the trust hit the highest bracket? $12,500. So that's why we want to be very careful and make sure there's a compelling need to name a trust, because the income tax consequences are severe. And that's got to be considered by the client to be the lesser evil than paying more out to the child. Steve, did you have a question or comment?
No, I'm with you.
All right. This is highly technical stuff, but it's meant to illustrate the hazard and the landmine of naming a trust as beneficiary. Is it necessary sometimes? Yes. Do we need to educate the client as to the ups and downs of that? Absolutely. Okay. I've got about 30 minutes left. Let me mention briefly marital trust. I mentioned the second marriage situation. So the client, and sometimes they're both in the room, I represent both of them, so it's a very frank discussion, because when I do joint representation, everything is open game to everyone. We have no secrets, or I won't do it. So if I'm both in the room, we're talking about, and the beauty is we don't know who the survivor is and who the first to die is going to be, unless one's 80 and one's 40. That happens in Florida a lot, but not here. So my discussion with them is, look, we can create a marital trust, and wife, your IRA can go into the trust and pay husband income, but then on husband's death, it will still go to your children, wife. So they like the sound of that. The problem is that trust will not qualify for spousal rollover. So by naming a marital trust, they're giving up all the advantages we talked about of spousal rollover. So they got to know that up front. Assuming they're okay with that, they got to know then the next year after your death, the trust starts taking distributions regardless of the age of the surviving spouse. Now, if we've set it up right, the trust will qualify as a designated beneficiary, and we can use the life or the surviving spouse's life expectancy for purposes of measuring those distributions. But when they hit the trust, only the income portion is what goes out to the spouse, so we've still got that layer of the distribution being taxed at trust income tax rates. So there are a lot of disadvantages to using the marital trust. I have tried alternatives with some success. What I've suggested to those individuals is, let's try perhaps splitting the IRA. Let's say it's $1 million IRA, and let's create two $500,000 IRAs. Obviously, we don't know what they'll be worth when the client dies, and direct one of those to the spouse and the other to the children of the prior marriage. Sometimes that works if there's enough money to spread around. Another tact I've tried with some success is, let's leave the non-retirement assets to your kiddos from the first marriage and leave the retirement asset to the spouse, so we still qualify for spousal rollover. Sometimes that works. Obviously, those alternatives all key on what's the relative level of wealth of both spouses, the retirement piece, and the non-retirement piece. If the estate is consisted of 90% retirement assets, you don't have many options other than maybe splitting those retirement assets. So, point is, I try to suggest alternatives to avoid naming a marital trust. So, that's my advice to you. Okay. There's a bunch of mumbo-jumbo in here I'm not going to bore you with about qualifying a marital trust for both minimum distribution stretching and for the estate tax marital deduction. I'll leave that to your reading some night when you can't sleep. Okay, let me see here. Let's shift gears and talk about creditor access. We know in all the states that my creditor cannot touch my retirement plan or my IRA. In some states, if I inherit an IRA from my mother, they can't touch that either. It's always big news when an estate planning topic goes all the way to the Supreme Court, because it's rare. Before the Clark case I'm about to discuss, the last estate planning issue to go before the Supreme Court involved a young lady named Anna Nicole Smith. We all know how that turned out, or maybe we don't want to know. But in any event, in the Clark case in 2014, the issue was, does an inherited IRA qualify under federal, emphasis on federal, bankruptcy law for exemption from creditors? And the Supreme Court, the circuit courts were split on the outcome, so it was a perfect case for the Supreme Court to decide. And in a unanimous decision, I mean, how often is the Supreme Court unanimous these days? Not often. But here, they were unanimous that an inherited IRA does not qualify for exemption under federal bankruptcy law. And they cited three characteristics which, in their view, said or dictated that an inherited IRA does not meet the definition of retirement funds. First, the holder of an inherited IRA may never make contributions to it, as opposed to traditional IRAs or Roths, which both receive tax incentives for making contributions to it. Secondly, a holder of an inherited IRA is required to withdraw money from the account without regard to how close or how far away they are from retirement. There's no relation to retirement. And thirdly, if the IRA were held to be exempt, there's nothing that prevents the holder from, on the day after bankruptcy discharge, taking the entire inherited IRA and spending it on stuff. So in a crowning blow, the court said there is literally nothing about an inherited IRA's legal characteristics that discourages an individual from using the entire balance immediately after discharge from bankruptcy. So the legal press and some of the layperson press reporting on Clark said, okay, inherited IRAs are fair game for creditors. And nothing could be further from the truth. Clark held that inherited IRAs are not exempt in federal bankruptcy. The reality is bankruptcy is federal court, but states have the right to opt out of the federal exemptions and use their own. In fact, more than half the states are opt-out states. Missouri and Kansas are opt-out states. In other words, if I file bankruptcy, my case is heard by a federal court that they have to apply the Missouri set of exemptions in determining what is fair game to creditors and what is exempt. And so that was not reported in the press. So if I'm in an opt-out state, it doesn't matter what Clark says. It matters what my state law says. So if you have an opt-out state, you've got three possibilities. You've got the state may have no law on it, in which case you're probably screwed. And at the planning stage, I need to emphasize, we're dealing with the owner of the IRA. And if that owner's in Missouri, that's fine. But what we need to be concerned about is, where do the beneficiaries live and what law will apply to them? I've got Illinois, Alabama, and North Carolina. So the second possibility is where Kansas is. Kansas is an opt-out state, so we're going to look to state law. Kansas does not have a specific statute dealing with inherited IRAs. It has a very broad statute that we used to argue that statute included inherited IRAs. Until October of 2015, when the Mosby case came down, where a Kansas district court held that under Kansas law, inherited IRAs are not exempt. And there are numerous states that reach that same result. There are other states that have such a broad statute, and they think it includes inherited IRAs, and they are exempt. If you have a particular case in a particular state, my committee of ACTEC has put together a 50-state chart that we monitor. And if you have a case in Idaho and you need to know the answer, let me know, and I'm happy to tell you what Idaho law is. Yes, sir.
Was there a question at one point about Roth IRAs exemption in Kansas, or is that?
There might have been, but if it's the participant,
right.
No, they're exempt.
Okay.
If it's the debtor, if it's the, I'm sorry, the inheritor, they're not exempt.
Okay.
Same rule applies.
Is there any discussion or cases, you mentioned that what matters is where the beneficiary
yes.
is physically located?
Yes.
What impact?
Domicile.
What impact, if any, does it matter when the IRA agreement says, let's take Fidelity's subject to the law of Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Does that even play at all?
It doesn't, because if the child is in bankruptcy, and they're in an opt-out state,
okay.
the bankruptcy judge is required to apply the law yeah. of that state.
Right. Okay.
Now, let's look at Missouri. Missouri has a very specific statute written by yours truly. But don't give me too much credit. I looked at Arizona and Florida. They already had such a statute, and I combined what I thought was the best of those. And the Missouri Bar Probate Committee endorsed it. We contacted the debtor-creditor committee. They gave no response, so we sent it on to the legislature, and they adopted it. And when it came into law, the debtor-creditor committee called our committee chair and said, what the heck? And we said, hey, we sent you a copy for your comment, and then we didn't hear anything else. But Missouri, Alaska, Arizona, Florida, and Texas, and now as of last October, Nevada, North Carolina, Idaho, there's a big state, there are 8 or 9 states that have a statute that specifically says inherited IRAs are exempt from creditors. So if my child moves back to Missouri and goes through bankruptcy and has one of his or her assets, their inherited piece of my IRA, it will be free from creditors. So it's a state-by-state determination. I think if a state like New Jersey, which is subject to federal law, it's not an opt-out state, then Clark is relevant. There's another level of attack on Clark, and I mentioned New Jersey for a reason. After Clark was held, New Jersey is not an opt-out state, so you would think they were subject to the Clark holding that inherited IRAs would be fair game. The attorney for the debtor got very creative and said, hold on a moment. You're talking about whether or not the IRA is exempt. I argue it's not part of the bankrupt estate in the first place, and the court agreed with the debtor. So in a case called Andolino in New Jersey, which was decided in late 2015, the bankruptcy court said the inherited IRA is not included in the bankrupt estate, therefore we don't have to get to the question of whether it's exempt. It's not in the estate in the first place. Unbelievable. Great lawyering. So obviously, despite the press reporting, Clark is not the end-all be-all in this area. Nonetheless, so my kids, let's see, Illinois, unfortunately, it's probably fair game. It's probably a Clark state. Alabama is one of those Kansas states that has a broad statute. They're not sure how it's construed. North Carolina, we have a Missouri statute in North Carolina. So I know my daughters is cool. My two sons are fair game, potentially. So what if your client has a child who is a spendthrift? Or may have creditor issues, and you know they live in a state where Clark is the law, then consider at the planning stage a spendthrift trust. Now, again, we've got to worry about the designated beneficiary hoops we got to go through. But at least with the spendthrift trust, and we'll pay more taxes, that creditor cannot reach in and grab trust assets to try to satisfy the debt of my child. So that's another possible alternative if you're dealing with a client whose child has creditor issues. Let me skip over.
Please. Is that based on where the child is domiciled?
It's based on where the child is domiciled.
Even if it's held in trust?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the trust is controlled by where the grantor was domiciled.
Right.
So let's say it's Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
But if the child is in Illinois, and the child's creditors are going after him in Illinois, that's
mm-hmm.
where Illinois law controls. So Missouri governs the law of administering the trust,
okay.
but in terms of access to the trust's beneficial interest, it's the domicile of the beneficiary.
Perfect, thank you.
Okay. Let's talk in the remaining few minutes, naming charity as beneficiary. I would submit if you have a client that says, and I met with one this morning before I came over here, that, you know, we want a good portion of our estate, they have no children, to go to these three charities. The first words out of my mouth is, you have, you know, $1.5 million between the two of you, and they're a younger couple. They've done very well in retirement savings. That's what no kids will do. Speaking of my children only, of course, I said, what we need to do is satisfy those gifts out of your retirement plan assets. Why? Whenever a charity receives something, they're not going to pay income tax on it, regardless of the point. They're tax exempt. Whereas if an individual receives distribution from an IRA, they're going to pay tax on it. If they receive other things, they won't. So, first words out of my mouth is, if we're going to leave gifts to charity, let's focus on your retirement plans or IRAs. So, that's what we're going to do for them. So that's easy. That's a beneficiary designation which says 50% to XYZ charity and 50% to my good nephew, Joe. That's pretty easy to do. Remember the separate account rule. What should happen after their death? Pay out that charity. Joe could do a separate thing of their own account and do distributions over Joe's life. Now, what I suggest when, and this happens a lot, when a beneficiary wants to leave either a percentage or a specific amount to charity and the rest to children or other individuals, I would use an attachment. And that attachment is going to clue them in on the fact that they should do separate accounts quickly after the participant dies. Anytime it's a charity and individual combination, that separate account treatment is key, because those individuals are going to come complaining to me or other people about why they can't stretch. So clues on the attachment, cover letters to the client to tell their children, all that stuff is a good CYA measure so the children aren't trying to hang you by the nearest tree when mom or dad dies. Okay? Be careful naming a trust as beneficiary when the trust beneficiaries are a combination of charity and individual. There was a letter ruling in 2014 where, there was specific bequests under the trust for two charities, and everything else got split among several individuals. And the IRS held that the taking out of an IRA, distributions by the trust, and paying out to the charities was not a tax-free event. They held that the entire amount of the distributions were taxable at the trust level, and there was zero offsetting charitable deduction. And now, who paid the price for that? Not the charities. They still got their money. The individuals had to pay tax on what they got and what the charities got. What should they have done instead? They should have used an attachment. Don't send it to the trust. Leave the trust out of it. Do an attachment to the beneficiary designation that mirrors what the trust would do. X percent to, or 50,000 to charity A, 50,000 to charity B, and the remainder split in three ways. We can definitely use separate accounts. We can cash out the charities, and the individuals can stretch. Here, They not only got no relief for the distributions to the charity, they increased their tax bill, and they couldn't stretch. So it was a perfect storm. So how does that happen? Well, it's so much easier to fill out the beneficiary form when you name the Bob Kirkland Trust. It takes work to do an attachment. It takes paying for advice to get that attachment done. But, again, clients left to their own devices can create a lot of revenue rulings. Now, again, don't lose heart and don't give up, because there was another ruling where the facts were the opposite. Specific gifts to individuals and the rest to charity. And there, the trust had a very effective post-death advocate who persuaded the IRS to rule that there were plenty of non-IRA assets to satisfy the individual gift, and therefore the IRAs were deemed to be paid directly to the charity. So don't give up. You might get a favorable ruling if you go for it. I've talked a lot about stretching. In the last 4 years, there have been 3 different bills introduced to do away with stretching. That's enough to scare me. In fact, in September of 2016, right before the election, the Senate Finance Committee unanimously endorsed a provision for a highway bill to fund that by doing away with the ability to stretch. And they estimated, I don't know, $4.6 billion would be raised by the lack of stretching and the acceleration of income tax on those distributions. Senate Finance Committee unanimous. That means bipartisan support. Then the election happened, and we haven't heard boo about doing away with stretching since. My good friend and undisputed heavyweight champion in this area, Natalie Choate. If you don't have her book, you need to get it. I keep it within arm's length, sometimes literally on the road. I don't have it today. That's my error for not having it right by my side when I give this talk. But I'm a little upset with her, because she wrote a highly published article that said, let's just do away with all this fall-to-roll and make it a flat 20-year distribution rule. Natalie, what are you doing? You're taking away all our fun. But, so you got all that noise out there, and so the question is, where there's smoke, is there fire? Now, in the current environment, getting anything passed is a challenge. So I don't think the stretch is going away in the next 9 months. But when something keeps coming up like that as a funding mechanism, particularly when we have so much debt, and such a deficit in spending, this is a relatively easy way to raise money at the federal government level. So we all should keep an eye on this and see what happens in the next few years, because it's come up 3 times now. It was part of President Obama's budget. They call it the Green Book, his budget proposal. I shouldn't say budget proposal. I don't think he ever had a budget. But tax proposals every year. Included doing away with the stretch, except for spouses, minors, and chronically ill people. That's been part of every proposal. So keep an eye on that. Let's assume for a moment they do take it away. One alternative to consider, particularly with your clients who are charitably inclined, is a charitable remainder trust. So how does that work? Let's say instead of naming my son to get 50% and my favorite charity to get 50%, I create a charitable remainder trust. And it says, pay out 6% of this trust to my son for his life. On his death, whatever's left goes to charity. And I name as beneficiary of my IRA this charitable remainder trust. Now, that means the IRA is going to pay out the whole kit and caboodle to the charitable remainder trust. Before we all keel over, the good news is a CRT, a charitable remainder trust, is tax exempt. So there's no immediate taxation. So the charitable remainder trust proceeds to invest, again, tax deferred, just like the IRA, and spit out 6% to my son every year. That's as close to the current stretch as we'll be able to get if they do away with the stretch. However, the caveat is you've got to have a client who's charitably inclined for that to really make sense. When I've tried to force charitable planning on someone who's not charitably inclined, it never ends well. They may get convinced on day one, but by day seven, they've got buyer's remorse. So let me stop babbling there. It's 1:25. Appreciate you all staying awake. Questions that you have before we convene, I'll give you guys on the phone one more chance. Any questions? Any questions here?
Any issues with using donor advised fund as a, say you leave 50% to your donor advised fund, you've got multiple beneficiaries you want to be left there,
yep.
Get it out, and then the other 50% either to individuals or trust.
That works. Okay. But you've reminded me of something I forgot to mention. I'll do it for 2 minutes. The charitable rollover. If a person is over 70 and a half, they're in pay status, they've reached their required beginning date. Each year, they can direct the IRA to not send them a check, but to send up to $100,000 max to a public charity. The consequences of that are it's not a distribution to the person. It can be used in lieu of the required distribution. There's, of course, no charitable deduction because there's no income event, but they got an indirect deduction by sending it to charity. I'm shocked that not more of my clients do that because it's a relatively easy thing to do. Even with charitably inclined clients, it's just something they're not used to or just not open to. But the reason I bring it up is that law does not allow you to do that to donor advised funds, even though they're considered a public charity for all other purposes. So I don't know why that is. You also can't use that technique for private foundations unless the private foundation agrees to immediately pay it out to a public charity. But that's a really nice technique for those seasoned clients who are charitably inclined. With that, I'll let you all go to more profitable activities. Thank you all very much.